I believe that we have what is in point of fact a fascist state in this country and Europe and increasingly in North America. It is a rather unholy alliance between state, banks and corporations. And I would suggest that that's exactly what we have now. The great strength of Britain was believing in the independence of the individual. We built a great nation on that basis, and it was based on the freedom of the individual. We don't have that now, and we have a generation that don't even expect it.
Welcome to the Staying Free podcast. In this episode, I spoke with Godfrey Bloom. Godfrey is a libertarian author with 6 books published on both military history and Austrian school economics. He earned international recognition in fund management in London before becoming an MEP for Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, where he campaigned heavily for Brexit for 25 years. His famous speeches in the EU Parliament on banking and tax malpractices have garnered a record 60 million views online, and he continues to advocate for truth and freedom on YouTube, Odyssey and Rumble. So when it comes to people who have been in politics, there's really not many people who have operated in that sphere that I would want to have on this podcast. I think it's very rare to find examples of people who have been in politics who actually have genuine principles and integrity, and whether you agree with them or not, they are willing to speak their mind and speak truth to power. And I definitely think that Godfrey Bloom is an example of this. He's someone who has never wavered from what he truly believes is right, and his fantastic speeches in the EU, which can be found online, really stand as a testament to Godfrey's character and the fact that he's definitely not like other politicians. So it was really great having the opportunity to talk to Godfrey. He really is one of a kind, and I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. If you did enjoy the episode, make sure you give it a like and a share on social media. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, give it a 5-star rating on whichever podcast app you're using. If you're new here, make sure you give the pod a subscribe for future episodes. If you want to support my work, you can do that in 2 ways. First is via Buy Me a Coffee, and the second is via Bitcoin Tips. Links for both of those are in the description. And please consider supporting the show and helping me grow by listening on the Fountain app. Getting started on Fountain is really easy. You can top up your Fountain wallet with a bank card or any Lightning wallet. Be sure to use my code in the description to start using Fountain today. And let's just see if I got any boosts in the last episode. I got one boost from Piers, who boosted 100 sats with the message, "Thank you, sir." Thank you, Piers, for that message and for sending some sats, as always. Once again, any way that you can support me is hugely appreciated, and all donations will go directly towards the cost of running the show. All right, let's get into the episode with Godfrey Bloom. So, Godfrey Bloom, I first heard about you quite a while ago, actually, when I watched some of your fantastic speeches that you did in the European Parliament. And I'm going to be sprinkling a few of those into this conversation, actually, just so that people get a bit of a context as to some of your political background. But before we kind of get into all that stuff, do you want to just give a bit of a general introduction as to yourself for those who haven't heard of you?
Sure. Well, basically, I am an investment fund manager in the city, or was for many, many years. And that's really my background. And I only went into politics very late in life because I was a Brexiteer. So that brought me into politics. But I'm not a professional. I never was a professional politician. I joined UKIP for one reason and one reason only. I finished sitting as an independent, not UKIP, because I rather fell out with the leadership, not the only one. And so that's really my background. A little bit of military as well. And I am an associate member of the Royal College of Defence Studies. And I finished my, so I've got some military experience. I'm a trained strategist. And I also finished my career in the city as a general manager, would you believe, of a life insurance company, because I was managing pension funds. So I have technical input on things like mortality statistics and excess deaths and so on. So quite a broad range,
Okay. And before you got into politics then, you know, because you've obviously had, you know, a career before that, as you point out quite a lot to the bureaucrats in the European Parliament, that a lot of them didn't have any kind of real career. What made you actually want to get into politics? Why did you decide that that was an avenue you wanted to go down? What motivated you there?
Well, I was getting into my middle 50s and I was a keen Brexiteer, and I was offered to stand for the European constituency of Yorkshire, which is where I live. We have a small holding. And so I was rather badgered into doing it, and rather surprised I got elected because it's proportional representation. So the little guys got a chance. And I won. And I won again 5 years later with a much, much bigger margin. And so that's how I ended up, almost by accident, you might say. So on the one hand, we got Brexit. And that was good. So it wasn't a wasted 10 years. On the other hand, of course, we've got a fake Brexit. And so we haven't grabbed all the opportunities that I hope we might. But of course, that's just the way the cookie crumbles, isn't it?
Yeah, so I do want to get into some of the Brexit stuff a bit later, hopefully, if we have time. But just first of all, you mentioned something there about having PR, and that was how you were able to get into the parliament. Do you support PR generally?
I didn't up until now, and I'm more sympathetic to it now because it actually increases the choice. You can only now vote red or blue. It's the same in North America. It's red or blue. It's a choice of two rather poor things, poor parties, and you end up getting the same policies anyway because it's the World Economic Forum now that runs us. It isn't the political parties, it's not Parliament, it's people that we don't even know, some of the names we don't even know. But we know the levers of power are held by World Economic Forum stooges like the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, the Leader of the Opposition, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and indeed the King. So it really doesn't matter who you vote for. I do have my own theory about this, how to improve it. And I would make it illegal for anybody to stand as a member of a party. You ought to stand in your constituency. My name is Howden and Halton Price. Stand up and say, my name is Godfrey Bloom and this is what I believe in. No rosettes, no badges. And people then would have to listen to the person say, I like him, I like what he's got to say, or I don't like him, whatever it happens to be. We're now getting an even lower class of MP with a label on. And you can see some of the most recent by-elections. I don't include George Galloway, incidentally, but some of the other by-elections, people who are very, very low-quality individuals, and some of whom are quite sinister. So I think you should stand on the stump and say, I'm me, this is what I believe in, no badges. And that would give us a representative government, which, of course, we clearly don't have at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you. That would be great if people did that. But I think, unfortunately, we kind of live in a world where people like simplistic answers. And I think that the party system kind of offers that to people. It's a way for people to say, well, I don't have to think, I don't have to research, I don't have to actually look into what people are saying and what they're doing. I can just, you know, go by this color. You know, the color red is my color because they generally have these views, or the color blue is my color. So I kind of think it will always trend towards that. Even if we banned it, I think there would be some, I guess, like second layer way of doing it, which would just emerge naturally. But I don't know. I don't know what you think about that.
I think you're probably right, but at least it would be an improvement on the situation that we have at the moment. Individuals would have to stand on a stump, and that would mean we would, by its very nature, get a higher standard of individual than we do now. I couldn't believe it because I'd never been involved in politics. I'd never belonged to a political party. And when I was elected, I started to meet politicians. Also, when I was on committees and various other things, quite senior politicians in the House of Commons. And the one thing, having worked for a very prestigious investment bank in the city, the one thing that amazed me was the very low quality, the very low caliber of politicians. I thought that perhaps the Green Bay's curtain would be drawn back, and I would understand then why politicians do such absolutely crazy things. You know, there would be a reason that I wasn't privy to as an ordinary citizen. That isn't true. They are incredibly stupid and corrupt, with almost no exceptions. With almost no exceptions. So I haven't voted for years. I have no intention of voting again.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I definitely share your sentiment there. So I just want to go into something a little bit different, but definitely something that's relevant to my podcast because we talk about it a lot here, which is Austrian economics. And you know, you're definitely someone who has been a big proponent of that, especially in politics where there's not that many people. You've got a great speech, kind of lecture on YouTube, which is titled "An Introduction to Austrian Economics," which is on the, I think it's the Oxford University Mises page. And I'm interested to know, what was your introduction to Austrian economics? Like, where did you hear about it or get into it? What was your kind of moment of realization that this was a superior system to this kind of Keynesian system, which, you know, most people seem to be under the spell of?
I was always hostile to Keynesianism. How I came to the Austrian school, it was very small salami slices, really. Because when you're managing money in the city, and I've been managing money in some format now for, well, for 40 years, you know, I joined the city in the late 1960s, got my professional exams, and worked my way up the system, as it were. And so that's what I actually did. And I gradually came to realize that the economic system that we had was flawed. Because it wasn't socialism or capitalism, it was mercantilism. And of course, an old geezer like me knows the label. We have at the moment mercantilism. We don't have capitalism. It's sort of called crony capitalism, which is a sort of a loose way of describing mercantilism, but it's not capitalism, it's corporatism. And it's the sort of thing that we had perhaps in the 19th century to a certain extent, the East India Company, so on and so forth, and the Hudson Bay Company, and that kind of thing. So I came to it very slowly, and then I joined the Mises Institute, where I was called. I went over there to lecture and do all sorts of stuff and met other people who were like-minded. You do tend, when you have a belief system of this kind of economic system, you tend to feel that you're the only person in the world that has it. So it was really nice to meet other people who were enlightened, as it were, in this particular thing. And if I'm ever asked, as I sometimes am, to explain it in one sentence, I always say the Austrian school has, we want nothing to do with government. I don't want to give the government anything, and I want nothing from the government. I just want to be left alone. And funnily enough, when I was on the stump getting elected the first time, I think it was during the smoking ban or something, but yet another rule and regulation by a member of the idiot English middle class. And I was parking the car in Leeds Airport, and there was a car park attendant came up to me, and he recognized me because I'd done some TV by that stage. And he said, Mr. Bloom, recognize you. And this is an ordinary working Joe in Leeds, a car park attendant. He said, Mr. Bloom, why can't they just leave us alone? And that sums up, that was a working man. Most people just want to be left alone. They don't want all these rules and regulations. And of course, it's got worse and worse and worse and worse. And it hasn't stopped. Since 2016, when we won the Brexit referendum, it was supposed to stop. We haven't rescinded any, and we're still adding new ones. So it's just got worse and worse and worse. But of course, it would do, wouldn't it? Because we have a World Economic Forum government, IMF, WHO, so on and so forth. So we are not our own masters. So that's where we are, as I see it, at the moment.
So this is a good time, actually, to bring in one of the clips which I mentioned I was going to bring in, which is a really fantastic speech that you did about, I believe the name of the clip on YouTube might be The Working Day of an Average Englishman.
And, I remember
you kind
that
of went
speech,
through,
yeah.
And you went through the whole from kind of morning to evening of the average Englishman and the amount they have to pay in taxes. So I'll play that out now for the listeners.
Now, on behalf of the Europe of Freedom and Democracy, for 2 minutes, Mr. Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wonder if you'll permit me to gallop through the working day of the average Englishman. He wakes up and he turns on his taxed telly to get the news. He leaves his heavily taxed house, gets in his heavily taxed car, he fills it with heavily taxed diesel. He gets to work to earn an income which, after income tax, employer and employee national insurance, a third of his income has disappeared. A third. He drives home and stops on the high street for a few articles for the house. His purchases are taxed at 20%. He calls in for a pint, over two-thirds of the cost of which goes in tax. He dreams of a family holiday abroad, but he can't afford the airport tax. He longs for the day that he can retire, but the politicians won't let him go. We must steal his savings, mustn't we? The financial transaction tax. The poor sap doesn't even know we've nicked it. Of course, with the commission, top salaries, income tax free, non-contributory pension schemes, it's difficult for you, isn't it, to imagine his distress? Because you're not in this game, are you? You're not in this game. You don't pay any of this. You don't pay any of this. On a more technical note, perhaps I can pick up, Mr. President, I draw the House's attention to my own lunatic committee's Amendment 39 to Article 4B. The withdrawal of legal title to untaxed transactions ever anywhere in the world. Sugar in the petrol tank, if you will. We're very much looking forward to the vote. We're watching to see which imbeciles commend it. I suspect it will be the same usual parliamentarian flat earthers.
So, listening back to that clip and just kind of reflecting on what you were saying there, you know, obviously, like you just said, you are someone who believes that government should leave the individual alone and the individual should ask nothing of the government. And I generally agree with that take. Where do you think that Britain is now? You know, because it seems to me that we've come so far from that ideology. We are just nowhere even close to that now. I mean, you know, we have this kind of supposedly left-right politics, but even the right, you know, even the Conservatives, you know, they are not purveyors of small government by any means. So where do you see Britain? And also, I guess, looking at that in a global context as well, are we typical? Or do you think that other nations now have kind of taken on the mantle of true kind of libertarian ideas and that Britain is kind of being left behind?
I don't know of any libertarian countries at all, to be honest. I think the nearest thing at the post-war certainly was John Cooperthwaite's Hong Kong. And that was as close to it comes. I don't know of any now. I believe that we have what is in point of fact a fascist state in this country and Europe and increasingly in North America. Now, I don't use fascism in the pejorative sense of the National Union of Students moron that shouts it, not knowing what it is. It is a rather unholy alliance between state, banks and corporations. And I would suggest that that's exactly what we have now with the globalist agenda, so on and so forth. I mean, it is fascism, and fascism was very popular in the 1920s, in Italy, of course, where it started, and to an extent, Germany. It's very popular. They seem to like it in Europe. Europeans like this kind of government. They're comfortable with this kind of government. And of course, the British, up until probably the last generation, are for the freedom of the individual. And I think the great strength of Britain was believing in the independence of the individual. And of course, who led the field in that, actually, but of course, the Great Enlightenment in Scotland. And we see on the 1st of April, with extraordinary legislation coming in with hate crimes and secret phone calls to the police and all this kind of thing. I mean, Voltaire actually explained how wonderful he thought the Enlightenment was and actually came to Britain to live because he was free. You got free freedom of speech. You had a free press. Who on earth would suggest now that we have a free press? Who on earth now would suggest we have freedom of speech? And of course, we have a generation, my nephews, as it were, or my great nephews, in point of fact, now I get older, are beginning to believe that that's the norm. They're beginning to believe that that's the normal way of living, that there's a little man in Whitehall who issues regulations, that the principles of English law, which have now been virtually abandoned, they're not being taught in schools. The standard of education is appallingly bad. I lectured at universities, many universities. I'm banned from some of them. I'm now banned from Cambridge when I wanted to give a lecture on the government of Lord Salisbury, which was obviously too hot to handle for Cambridge undergraduates. All this kind of thing is... I actually was also booked to speak at Stirling University on the potential benefits under the Austrian School of Economics to Scotland if they adopted Austrian School Economics. I was banned. I was banned from that as well. We do not have freedom of speech under any circumstances. We don't have freedom of the press, and they are and the principles of English law were the pillars on which built the greatest empire the world's ever seen, for better or for worse. And we could argue about that another day. We built a great nation on that basis, and it was based on basically the freedom of the individual. We don't have that now, and we have a generation that don't even expect it. So we have 80% of the population, which is, I think, is a standard thing. It's not just this country. A little while ago, I did the Smithsonian psychology course because I wanted to find out why people thought the way they did. You know, how can we deal with cognitive dissonance as we do? Why do people believe what they do? How can they be so intellectually lazy when even around them they can see that what they're being told by government isn't true? But I didn't understand this. I got nowhere, incidentally. I didn't learn the secret with my Smithsonian course. It was an interesting course, but it didn't give me any answers. So I think this is the problem. 80% of the population will always go with the flow. That's true of America. That's true of Europeans. Most people just will go with the flow. And they won't challenge. There's no school, there's no educational system that talks about critical thinking. They don't understand critical thinking or risk analysis. And of course, being the general manager of a life insurance company, risk analysis is part of what I do, an investment risk analysis. And the funny thing is, we all do risk analysis every day. And I live in rural Yorkshire. Risk analysis, do I overtake this tractor and trailer? Is there room? Can I see far enough? So on and so forth. And it's a risk analysis. And I say, the risk is very low now, I can overtake. And we all do that all the time. We change our jobs. It's risk analysis. So people can do it. They do in their private lives. But it seems if the government tells them to do something, they seem to abandon risk analysis or critical thinking. And nothing came clearer than that than COVID. We now have people were going up and having jabs in the arm with no question of knowing what was going on or how it worked or what the mortality statistics were. They watched the BBC and simply believe it and still do. People actually believe what they see and hear on the BBC. Now, to you and I, that's astonishing. It's astonishing that anybody would do that. But people do. Most people do. Otherwise, quite intelligent people. Friends of mine. You know, which I've given up arguing with, because you can't make an argument with people who are governed by emotive thinking. Most people base their thinking on emotion, not analysis. And there are few of us. So maybe there's no light at the end of the tunnel. All we can do is perhaps go off grid.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about COVID, actually. I was going to ask you the question. Do you feel like it kind of re-radicalized you, Godfrey? Because for me personally, that was what started this whole thing. That was what started me doing this podcast. And, you know, I've kind of left the UK. I'm now living in Mexico. And, you know, one of the big reasons for that as well was because of everything going on with COVID and because of the kind of, you know, restriction on freedom that was, you know, so prominent in the UK. I'm interested to know if you feel like this topic has kind of re-radicalized you in a way, you know, after Brexit, as the next thing for you to kind of, the next battle to fight, essentially.
Yes, I think it did, actually, Johnny. I think it did. And when we had lockdown, which is quite against the British constitution, you know, people think we don't have a constitution because it's not written like the American one, but we most certainly do. You know, we have the Bill of Rights, the Toleration Acts, habeas corpus, all these things that we have, common law, statute law, all these things were driven, the coach and horses was driven through. And that made me extremely angry when the government was telling us how many people we could have to a dinner party. You know, we could have six mm-hmm. people. I was deliberately inviting an extra two. and we have a small holding. We built a sort of mini pub in the yard, and we have a very small village. The villagers came around every Friday night. They brought their own booze, and my wife put on bangers and mash or something. Quite deliberately, I was not going to be locked down by these dreadful, ghastly people, politicized police, and all the other morons that actually took part in it. I took no part in lockdown at all. I did not have anything to do with it. I carried on with my life, as did my wife. We just won't have it. Yes, it did. It re-radicalized me. It did, yeah.
Were you surprised to see some of the politicians, and I guess not just politicians, but prominent people who, in my opinion, should have taken a real stand against this and seemed to just kind of go quiet? You know, like it really kind of frustrated me. I mean, even some people who I think maybe started off saying the right things, like Peter Hitchens, but kind of, you know, eventually just kind of caved. It seemed to me like a lot of people were disappointing on this topic, you know, and especially in the political realm. Did you experience that as well?
Yes, I totally agree. There were one or two stood up, but they were very, very few indeed. I mean, one would have thought Jacob Rees-Mogg would have led the charge against this kind of thing on a much higher intellectual plane, but he didn't. Nobody was prepared to go against it. And of course, what was interesting, and I think Neil Oliver particularly made this point, and I'm with him on this, and that is, when you could see they were all on their wearing their masks for the photo call and all took them off immediately, and the fact that they were partying and having fun and doing all these things leads me to believe that they knew this was not a serious pandemic. Indeed, if it was a pandemic at all, they knew, as I knew, because I understand the interpretation of mortality actuarial statistics, that nobody was dying. You know, where were the bodies? Now, if you look at your history and you look at the great plagues of the 1300s and 1600s, they were piling up dead bodies in the streets. It was pretty much of getting nastily similar in 1918. With the great Spanish flu. There were no dead bodies. Where were the dead bodies? The only dead bodies we're getting now are the people, are young people, died suddenly. What a mystery. What could that be? Oh, Lord, what a mystery that all is. All these young people, athletes and all the rest of it, dying on the sports fields of cardiac arrest or brain hemorrhages, all the rest of it. So, no, nobody stood up against it, but quite clearly the political class didn't believe it themselves. They didn't believe it. So it was about a power grab. It was about power, political power, as a run, a practice run for the globalists stuffing us into 15-minute cities and all the things that go with it. Maybe, I don't know, perhaps, because it's now, as every week goes by, the fraud is being more exposed. The truth is coming out because you can't hide. You can't hide the truth. You can't hide the numbers anymore. That maybe people are beginning to start waking up with their critical thinking, risk analysis, and so on and so forth. I have many friends who've had heart trouble, otherwise physically fit, and they still think that it's just an extraordinary coincidence. Some people you can't help. Some people just don't join the dots. But I think perhaps they will start to join the dots. And maybe their next fake pandemic, which they're already planning, not because I'm a conspiracy theorist, I'm a conspiracy and analyst. They're all quite up front of it. The WHO, Bill Gates, and all the rest of them have told us there will be another pandemic. They told us it's coming, smirk, smirk, as they do when they're being interviewed. So it's not a conspiracy theory. That's what they're saying is going to happen. Whether or not people will line up now for compulsory medication, or call it what you like, I don't know. I think they're going to find it a bit more difficult this time.
I think they will find it more difficult, but there is also a part of me that saw what happened during those years and people's ability to just not confront the truth, or to kind of, I guess, take on a narrative that was completely in contradiction to their own experience of the world. You know, I mean, we saw these videos coming out of China with people just dropping dead on the floor, and then we saw what did we see that in our real lives? Did anyone actually go out on the street and say, oh, I've just seen someone, you know, dropping dead at a bus stop? Of course not. Like, none of that actually happened. You know, we were being told, oh, you know, everyone's getting COVID and so many people are dying. And then when you ask people, do you know anyone who's died of it? They might say, oh, well, yeah, you know, like my great uncle died recently. He was, you know, 89 and already in hospital. But, you know, but the thing is, this is what people were experiencing, but they still chose to take on the narrative. And I think that we've come so far now into this world in which people just want to fit in, people don't want to speak out, they don't want to say or do anything that goes against the norm, that they're willing to take very drastic actions, like literally, you know, going out and taking an injection in your arm for something which you have absolutely no evidence of that you need, and you have no evidence that this thing is safe. That is so far down the line to me of absurdity and kind of a dangerous psychology to be adopting. I don't know where we go from there. So yes, I although I agree with you, there will be more resistance for the next one. I suspect it still won't be that much, because it's very easy during the times when, like right now, when everyone says, oh, well, COVID's all over, so next time I'm not gonna fall for it, I'm not gonna take the vaccine or take the thing. But when the thing happens and you've got it on the news every day and they're showing these, you know, big red numbers on the screen, I think people will fall in line again. I'm just not convinced that many people have learned lessons. Some have, some will trickle over, but I still, unfortunately, have a lot of pessimism. But that doesn't mean I'm pessimistic more generally, because I actually think it doesn't take a majority of people to change things, to change the course of history. I think it takes a very, very kind of radicalized minority, which I think that we have. So I'm not too worried about the masses, but just interested to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I read a biography last year of Joseph Goebbels, and it was absolutely quite fascinating. He was obviously an evil genius when it comes to propaganda. And we're watching that unfold itself now, certainly in Western society. So he said there are some golden rules on propaganda. First of all, you must not allow dissent. There can be no dissent. Because if people get together in the pubs or the bars or whatever it is, and somebody's articulate and somebody's well-informed, that dissent, people go, he's got a point, or I didn't think of that, or whatever it happens to be. So you must not allow dissent. And of course, when the thought takeaway from Davos was we must not allow, they didn't say dissent, misinformation, which is not government information. So that was the number one priority. And they were quite open about that. It's more important than climate change. It's more important than anything else. We've got to clamp down on misinformation, i.e. Mm-hmm. the government, dissent, is what they mean, of course, is dissent.
Yeah.
And the other thing that Goebbels said, it must be based on emotion. You will not be able to sit down. You've probably experienced this with some of your friends. I know I have. There is no point in pointing to facts or data or statistics. It will not change their mind. Mm-hmm. Their minds are hermetically sealed to fact. And Goebbels knew this. You must appeal to emotion. And of course, the fascinating thing that we see it now at the moment is the intense propaganda on all our channels in Britain and Western Europe that Putin is some kind of monster, and the Russian Federation is exactly the same as the Soviet Union. And we all need to be aware, because when he's finished with Ukraine, he's coming for Poland, he's coming for Romania. As a trained geopolitical military strategist, LCDSN, and I'm also a military historian, published military historian, this is complete and utter and total bollocks. But 99 people out of 100 believe it, and they get the Daily Express. Now, I've devoted my life to this kind of subject, but the man who's read today's Daily Express thinks he's my equal. He really does, bless him. And a piece only today in the Daily Telegraph. Now, I remember when John Keegan and Claire Hollingworth were the defense correspondents of the Daily Telegraph. They were giants in their field. John Keegan was a lecturer at Sandhurst, my old alma mater. So these people were really great. We've got a Con Collin, who is the defense correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, who I believe is part of the Operation Mockingbird. It's impossible to believe the article he wrote today or yesterday wasn't written by the CIA. It's impossible to believe that it wasn't. It's that we must arm, we need to rearm, we need to increase our armaments, because Putin's coming for us next when he's finished with the Ukraine. And this has been pumped into people now for 3 years. And they believe it because Tony Benn, of course, you will have seen the clip of Tony Benn. He said, if you want to control people, you have to keep them ignorant and fearful. And what they do now is they keep us ignorant by closing down a free press, and fearful If it's not COVID, it's Putin. If it's not Putin, it'll be something else. You have to have a bogeyman. You have to frighten people into compliance. And of course, if people are ignorant because they don't know where to find information, they're easily controlled. And that's where you lose. That's where you lose the problem of a free society and free independence. If you take away a free press and all the other things that go with a free society, people become zombified and they just hunker down, go about their business, like living lives of basically of quiet desperation. And I have every sympathy. People say, Godfrey, why do you bother? Why do you bother with all this? Why do you bother keep fighting against the system which is giving us fake science? I mean, the biggest fake science is that man-made carbon dioxide is going to create a boiling world and we're all going to die. Nothing could be more ridiculous than that. But of course, that's a narrative. But who gives the narrative? Not independent scientists, actors, celebrities, royals, TV personalities. And of course, dissent isn't allowed. So nobody you will see on the BBC saying, just a minute, just let's have a look at the facts and figures, how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere years ago. How do you explain the Phoenician warm period, the Roman warm period, the mini ice age? How do you explain all these things? So you can have a debate, but you won't find people like Professor Ian Plimer, for example, or even the Nobel the Nobel Prize winner who said it's rubbish. Not allowed on TV because dissent isn't allowed, because it's a form of political control. We're saving you. The state is making you do this, this, and this for your own benefit. Now, I've often said this, and I say it at universities. When the medieval king took your wife, took your castle, took your money, burnt your village, or whatever the medieval king did, he was an honest thief. He said, I can do this because I've got lots of men, they're all armed, and I can do what I'm like because I'm the king. Fair enough. But when you're robbed daily through the taxation system, which is just, of course, taking money through threat of violence, that's what taxation is. I get really annoyed when people are saying it's for your own benefit. And I say to undergraduates sometimes, if you're walking down the road and somebody comes up behind you and bashes you over the head and steals your wallet and then kneels down and says, this is for my old mother. So I'm sorry I've bashed you over the head and stolen your money, but it's for a good cause. It's for my poor old mum. He's still robbing you with violence. That's what the state does. And I find that particularly irritating when, give you a classic example of this, my wife is much younger than me. She's 62, something. She can't have her old age pension. She's worked all her life. She's a physiotherapist, chartered physiotherapist. She cannot have a pension until she's 67. Because the government says we can't afford it. Okay, the government got it, but just a minute. She's been working since she left college. She's been working all her life, paying tax all her life, paying her stamps and bits and pieces. She can't have it, she's 67. Well, then you wake up in the morning, we've given another £5 billion to the Ukraine. £1 billion a month in unaudited foreign aid. High-speed rail too, £100 billion. So they got plenty of money, but not for our women folk who've worked all their lives to get their pension at 65. It's the most degraded I've ever known the country. I'm 74, 75 at the end of the year. I've seen a lot of shit, believe me, including the 70s. I have never known the state of the country be so bad, so low. And of course, at the moment, it hasn't actually got the man on the Clapham omnibus yet. People don't go to the barricades with a full tummy. But that day is coming. Currency is being degraded. Banks will crash. Unemployment will shoot up. We will go into recession, if not a depression. And then people will say, where did all the money go? Where's all this tax that I've paid? Every year, ordinary working Joes, not people in the public sector who protect it, ordinary working Joes, the brickie, the cabbie, the barman, the ordinary people getting about their business are going to go, just a minute, where did it all go? There's nothing left for me. But we've got illegal immigrants in four-star hotels. Is it for me? What am I getting? They're going to say. So things could get very nasty. We'll see.
I'm just going to use this opportunity, Godfrey, because you mentioned a couple of points that are going to relate quite well to another couple of clips that I want to play out. So I'll do these ones both back to back, and then I just got a couple more questions for you on that topic.
Sure.
So the first clip is actually, it's one of your speeches again, which is about companies doing their own business and not being interfered with. So I'll play that one out now.
I would simply counsel you, madam, to let companies do their business, and the less you regulate, the less you tax, the less you interfere, the quicker our economy will recover. That's what it's all about, and that's something you simply don't understand.
Okay, so that's clip number one on this topic, and then I'll just play out another one as well, which is when you were talking about people having self-responsibility for their children.
I believe, madam, that children are the responsibility of their parents and nobody else. I do not accept that somebody takes responsibility of his neighbour's children. That it is for the parents to take responsibility of their children, and that's how it should be. And the more self-responsibility that we have in Europe and indeed the world, the better the place would be, in my view.
So a couple of questions on those, because it relates quite nicely to what you were just saying there about, you know, how much the government should actually interfere, how much they should tax, you know, where is the line? And I'm really interested to get your view on this, because obviously, you know, you've been in politics, so you've had, you know, experience in that world. But, you know, when we talk here today, it sounds like you are, you know, much more towards not just the libertarian, but I would say almost an anarchist camp. You know, I'm interested to know your view on whether you think that any taxation is legitimate or whether you think that all taxation is fundamentally illegitimate.
It's a difficult question. I was asked this by some of the Mises undergraduates in Auburn some years ago, and it isn't easy. But I would suggest that, let me suggest a system that I think would work. Let's say that we could have a card, you know, like an American Express, about that kind of size, you know, a sort of a gold card thing. Mm-hmm. And you can opt out. So I would say, I don't want anything from the state, but I'm opted out of everything from the state, but of course I'll be opted out of tax. So when you go in and get your car filled up with petrol, more than half of which is tax, of course, you show the card, and it doesn't cost £100 to fill the tank of your car. It costs £50 because there's no tax to pay because you're not having anything back. So when you go and have your pint of bitter or your bottle of wine, 50% of which is taxed again, your pint of bitter isn't £5, it's £2.50. So when you go and buy your car, a £30,000 family car, of which £6,000 is VAT, there's no VAT. So your car is only 24,000, not 30,000, so on and so forth. So you have this wonderful card that you show. That actually gives you enough money, enough of your own money back, to have your own private insurance, health insurance, to go about. You don't need the state, because you've got far more money in your own pocket. See, they talk about a minimum wage or a living wage now. It's gone up to £11. Or £11.50 in this country. Well, of course, and the government say, aren't we wonderful? This is wonderful. We've ensured that the employer pays you the living wage of £11.50. Well, because it isn't so simple as that. It doesn't work like that. What actually happens is in the hospitality industry, if you've got a pub and you opened your restaurant every night of the week, you can't afford to pay your chef and your waitresses, all that kind of thing. So you only open at weekend. So you start sacking people. Or if it's manufacturing, you move your manufacturing to India or to China because you can't afford £11 an hour for unskilled labour or semi-skilled labour. And if you have to pay your waitress that, what you then have to have your differential, your chef wants more money. And so it goes on. So you have all that kind of interference which crucifies everybody. If you took that out of the system, we could all live very comfortably. And you say, oh, what about social care? What about social welfare, Mr. Bloom? So I said, well, look, you're going to have so much more money left, right? You're going to have so much more money left in your pocket. You can then contribute to whichever charity of your choice is going to help people who are in need of care. And of course, if you go back to 1943, 1944, Beveridge, for example, the start of the welfare state, as we know it today, the concept was you paid your stamp every week, and that entitled you to free at the point of delivery your health care and a modest pension when you retired. And if you fell on hard times through no fault of your own, the state would look after you. But of course, any serious historian will tell you, or will know, that if you go back before the welfare state, that's what your mutual societies did. That's what your friendly societies did. You paid your stamp into them, but of course, the difference with them, they wouldn't attempt to swing the lead. You couldn't be, that couldn't be welfare or social care, could not be a lifestyle choice. And you'd paid in your stamp, and somebody would make absolutely sure that you weren't swinging it. So you don't need the state. People think they need the state. You don't need the state, but people think you do, because who is going to explain to people how much better off they would be if they paid no tax on anything at all? Now, let's say, who would argue, say, oh, yeah, what about the police? Well, let's be frank. The police are useless. The police are utterly useless now. So I don't want to pay the police. In my little village, with all the money that we had left over, it's zero crime territory anyway, because it's a tiny little issue. But we would have a private security system like they have, for example, in Beverly Hills or in Cape Town. You pay for your protection, and the police, you pay them, the police do what you want them to do, which is protect you and your property. Now, who do they protect? They're too busy on their computers finding out who tweeted something nasty. And then they come around and say, you tweeted something nasty and it's a hate crime and blah, blah, blah. So the police aren't doing that. Well, they're useless. So we would have a much more efficient police force if we paid them, because they'd dance to our tune. He who pays the piper calls the tune. That's not happening at the moment. Our police force is rubbish. And everything the state does is rubbish. The national health system, for example. It has a budget of something like £170 billion a year. If you divide that into the people in the wealth-creating sector paying tax, it works out at something in the region of £16,000 each per year. So we're not getting much. It employs 1.2 million people, the National Health. It's the biggest employer after the Chinese Army or the Indian Railways. I can't, one or the other. Well, how can it be that only 50% of those employees have any form of medical qualification? How can that be? But it's true. So what do they all do? I know you need some cleaners and bits and pieces and all the rest of it. But do you need 600,000? Well, of course you don't. And only this morning I was talking to a lady. She was waiting for an MRI scan. She'd been waiting for several weeks. And I said, if we took the money that we'd given to the Ukraine for armaments, we could, I think it's somewhere in the region, we could have had 260 more MRI scanners in the country. And do you know what she said? She said, oh, well, I know, but it's helping people, isn't it? It's helping the Ukraine. This is the depth of propaganda. She was quite happy to have a long waiting list for her own MRI scan in pain with her back, because she felt sending money to the Ukraine for armaments to one of the most corrupt governments on the planet, she thought that was such as her propagandized view of the world. But then we don't have a free press. Why aren't the free press? Shouldn't the press be screaming, what does 600,000 people do? Diversity office, net zero officers, and all the rest of it. Where are the doctors and where are the nurses? That's what we want. Where are the MRI scanners? That's what we want. But that's not what we're getting. Free at the point of delivery. Well, as an Austrian school economist, you could, free at the point of delivery. I mean, you couldn't invent a more ridiculous way of running a system, could you? Imagine a pub with beer free at the pump. So you go into the pub, it's run by the state, and it's paid out from taxation. The bogs would be a disgrace. The beer would be a disgrace. The bar staff would be a disgrace, wouldn't they? The whole thing would be a shit show. But when it's owned by, like my local is, it's owned by a landlady who rules the roost, and she's a bloody good landlady. The beer's bloody good, and there's a choice of them. The service is crisp. Everything is good. And in the winter, there's a nice big log fire. It's because she runs it, not some arsehole in Whitehall.
Yeah, so I agree with a lot of what you say there, and you know, especially kind of as it pertains to like inefficiencies. But in terms of that second clip that I played out there about the having self responsibility for other people, I think this is actually more of an ethical point. And I'll just go over just one of the key points made there, which was, I do not accept that somebody takes responsibility for their neighbor's children. It's for the parents to take responsibility for their children, and that's how it should be. And I think that is a very important point because, okay, it might sound to somebody who hasn't really gone into the ethics of libertarianism or the ethics of anarchism to say, oh, well, that sounds callous. You know, it sounds like a callous point. But actually, all we're saying and all I think that is being explained in that point is, you know, should someone have the right to steal from you to give to someone else? Should someone be able to shake you down and say, I'm going to take your money and give it to this person because they're needy? I mean, they might be more needy, and it might be objectively true that if someone comes down, you know, on the street to you, you're walking along the street and they say, oh, you've got a really nice expensive jacket there. Let me just take it off your back and give it to a homeless person because they don't have much money and they're more needy and they can actually buy food, et cetera, with it. Well, that might be true. That person might get more out of that. You don't really need the velvet jacket or whatever, but actually you've just committed a fundamental ethical wrong by doing that, even if it ultimately has a positive outcome. So I'm interested to know whether you look at libertarianism in the same way, in that it's more of an ethical question, actually, than an economic question or a question of efficiency.
Yes, I do. I take a very strong moral view. I think it is immoral to take money from somebody under the threat of violence, which is what tax is, to give to somebody else, whether it's a good cause or not. That isn't the point. But of course, if you leave more money for the individual, you'll see more philanthropy. Now, if I had been left a lot more money over the years, I once worked out how much I'd paid in tax since I left school, came to well over 2 million, you know, stocking it all up. I did it 10 years ago as an exercise on a long train journey. You know, I just worked it all out. Very big booze bill, I'm afraid. So a lot of the tax went on booze. But that doesn't mean to say I would abrogate my responsibilities morally. So, for example, if I had a neighbour who had fallen on hard times, or there was who had a child with cerebral palsy or something like that, I would help out. You know, as a traditional Christian, I would regard it as my moral duty to help out. But not at the point of a gun. Not under threat of imprisonment. I don't need that to make me do my duty as a traditional Christian. But so I would look after people. Now, for example, I have sponsored sport. I've been sponsoring junior sport in one way or another for years. I don't now, but I did, you know, mini rugby, junior rugby. I sponsored Cambridge University women's rugby for 10 years. I've spent quite a lot of money on youngsters' sports. So, you know, I do my WAC, and I've done other charities as well. But that's my business. It's nobody else's business that I do that. And I think more people, and if you look at the amount that we still give in this country per capita, the British are the most generous nation. I think of every single nation, we give more, sometimes naively. And stupidly, we put our hand in the pocket. As soon as we see the Red Nose Day on the telly, or we see this, I'm trying to lead the charge on never give. My motto is never give money to a charity if the CEO earns more than you do. And I was asked the other day for a charity, not particularly well-known charity, but it was big enough. And the first thing I did is I checked out to see what the CEO earned, and the CEO is earning £120,000 a year, which in retirement is more than I'm earning. So he doesn't get any money. If they can afford to pay a CEO or save the children or save the planet, all these charities, if you look at what the CEOs are earning, sometimes £200,000, £250,000 a year, well, they clearly don't need my money, do they? Mm-hmm. If they can pay their executives, then people say, oh, we've got to get the best people. Then you look at the CV of these people. failed Liberal Democrat politicians. All the riffraff and flotsam and jetsam of society, of political society, Jobsworths, Quangos, all these people are just ghastly. They're not getting my money. But I do give money. When I was in office, I didn't take the salary and I didn't take the pension, non-contributory pension, and the attendance allowances I gave to local charities. So, for example, we have a charity not that far away, Rescues Greyhounds, and it's run by a lady who lives in a shack with all these greyhounds. You give her 100 quid, the 100 quid goes straight to the greyhounds, the abandoned greyhounds or dogs. Right. You give it to the RSPCA, you've got a whole bunch of people on £200,000 a year with an index-linked pension who don't need it. So local charity, and that comes back full circle, if you will, to libertarianism. And am I an anarcho-capitalist, if you will? Which is a good question. I'm never quite sure. But if you keep local government small, if you keep your government, such government you need, small and unpaid, so it's pro bono publico. My father was a bigwig in the Conservative Party in London as a councillor. They didn't dream of getting paid. There were no expenses. It was pro bono publico. And so consequently, we need to get back to that. Cantons in Switzerland, for example. Now, Switzerland isn't perfect, make no mistake. I know it's not perfect. But Switzerland is much closer to representative democracy than we'll ever be. Because I don't have anything, nobody has anything in common with members of parliament in Westminster. But if it was local, if the local publican or the local builder, somebody local, and we had a small little board of directors for Howdenshire. I live in Howdenshire, which is a sort of subdivision of the East Riding of Yorkshire, which is a subdivision of Yorkshire, if you will. So we'd all know each other. The advantage in Switzerland is that they all know each other. They know the guy is good. They know the guy's not on the take. They know the guy is sensible. So that's the kind of... Then we do need some administration, and it can't get out of control because we're all in charge of it. We're all running it. At the moment, they don't care what we think because they know we're stuck. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere for us to run to. And it doesn't matter if we vote for Starmer or vote for Sunak because they're both WEF. So why would they care what we think? They don't care. So they would care if they could, if they were responsible. And we met them on the tube. I remember Julia Hartley Brewer, who's a sort of controlled opposition fake, fake kind of woman who pretends that she's poking the establishment and deep state, but she's part of the system. Matt Hancock, the appalling Matt Hancock, he was jostled on the tube and she was outraged. We can't have our politicians jostled. He killed hundreds and hundreds of old people with his appalling, arrogant strategies through COVID. Jostled any other country. They wouldn't have jostled him on the tube. They'd have strung the bastard up. So, they should get jostled. That's the whole point of it, isn't it? If you're a crooked politician, you're going to get jostled. And worse, if I'd seen the bugger.
Yeah, I mean, in one of my first conversations I had on the podcast, it was with someone called Richard Nichols, and he said that in his where he lives, it's a relatively small community, and they'd lost all telecommunications for something like a week, and it wasn't getting fixed, and it was the responsibility apparently of the politician. They took him out into the woods and gave him a phone, and by the time he came out of the woods, it was all sorted again. It just it took a bit of a shakedown, but I guess that's the kind of society that emerges from having, more of a smaller kind of community-driven society. And maybe that's where we should go. Maybe we should actually, maybe the problem is that government works up to a certain scale and then, it stops working. And I think that, the smaller the better, really. I mean, I do consider myself to align with the ethics, at least, of anarcho-capitalism. When it comes to actually in practice, would it work? I don't know. I don't know if it's ever really... been tried to the point that we can actually say, okay, that was a good experiment. But I think the smaller the better. And I think you can actually look at, data around the world and the way different countries are doing things and say, that does work. And, this also ties in as well to what you were saying about in terms of kind of charity and things like that. You are much more likely, I think, in a world where government doesn't exist to kind of take away all of our responsibilities for other people, I think it's much more likely that people will do things for their local community. You know, if you're paying taxes and you're every year you're saying, oh my God, you know, like 50% of my income is being paid to taxes, well, then you don't have that much of a kind of impulse to say, I'm going to go and take what's left and go and give it to causes that I care about. But if you're not having that money taken by government, then you say, well, it's my responsibility. Who's going to do it? If, you know, if not me, who? You know, that doesn't exist when you're in this kind of extreme kind of socialist paradigm. So yeah, I just think that the outcomes would be better in that world as well, because, you know, everything would become more local, and it would breed a kind of personal responsibility into society that necessarily has to be actualized.
You have to have it worked with John Cooperthwaite in Hong Kong post-war because the Chinese had a work ethic. And I know some people have work ethics and some people don't have work and some are stronger than others. But you see, you soon get a work ethic if you've got an empty tummy. If you're perfectly healthy, but you're getting as much for watching daytime TV on the sofa as you would be picking sprouts in November in North Yorkshire, you're not going to pick sprouts in North Yorkshire. But if you can't pay your TV, you can't afford your mobile phone, you can't afford to go out for a drink and all the rest of it because you're not working, which is how Hong Kong worked post-war. John Cooperthwaite used to say, my job is to make sure the drains work and the police aren't corrupt. That's it. And of course, the income per capita overtook virtually the rest of the world in one generation. It can be done. It can be done, but you need your role model. And I would suggest you could do no worse than John Cooperthwaite's post-war Hong Kong. But everybody thinks that the state must look after them. And I did a lecture once at York University, and I'm going back well over 10 years. And as a serving politicians, and I said, look, you know, do you I'm a politician. Here I am, a real live politician making law. Or in the amending chamber of the parliament, I won't go to that sort of rabbit hole, but there we are. I'm making law for you and your family. Do you think I can make law for the benefit of you and your family better than you can make it for yourself? And horrifyingly, they all went, oh, and a lot of them said, oh, well, I think that, yeah, I think the state can do that better than I could do. Where do people's self-confidence go?
So, Godfrey, I just want to, you've been very generous with your time, so I don't want to kind of go over because I know you've got guests arriving, but there is just a few more points I want to touch on. Are we okay
far away.
Kind of another 10 minutes or so. You can be as brief as you like on these. But okay. Yeah, it would be amiss for me not to go into this topic because a lot of my listeners are Bitcoiners, and I know that they will be interested to know your view on this. I know that you have kind of had your first touch with Bitcoin, because I've heard you on some of the Bitcoin podcasts talking about that. Interested to know where you're up to with that journey, how you kind of see Bitcoin in the whole this whole tapestry of what's going on at the moment in terms of global economics, you know, both personally and I guess on more of a geopolitical level as well.
Well, the advantage of Bitcoin is, of course, you take your money off the table. What you need to do is not have your money in a bank, not be beholden to central banks. And the thing that Bitcoin does is it takes it off the table. It takes you off grid when it comes to your money. And I'm a gold bug, but everybody has a different risk reward view. So when you get to my age as an old geezer, gold for me, I don't want the volatility. And I've been building a gold portfolio for over 20 years. So I started buying my gold at £250 an ounce. This morning it was £1,700 an ounce. Wow. That works out at 8.5% compounded since I started changing my portfolio from equities to gold. So that is for me, that works for me. Now, if you're young, if you're younger, and you've got a much longer time horizon, you can stand the volatility. So you can stand the volatility of Bitcoin. Now, I made money out of Bitcoin, so, you know, and I think Bitcoin is a good idea. But Bitcoin has further to go yet. and I think most Bitcoin, some of the people I speak to and I've done podcasts with, Richard Breedlove, for example, and others, extremely well-informed and well-read people. Very interesting doing their podcasts with them because they really understand what they're doing. The problem sometimes with some hodlers is, you know, they've got probably $1,000 worth of Bitcoin in Des Moines or somewhere like that, and they haven't a bloody clue what they're doing. They just can't see down the thing. And of course, we've just seen that a little bit with ETFs, Bitcoin ETFs. I understand ETFs. As this guy, I've done this for 40 years. I've done this sort of stuff for a living. If you're buying a gold ETF or a Bitcoin ETF or a silver ETF, you're not getting gold, silver, or Bitcoin. You're getting a counterparty promise from BlackRock. Mm-hmm. But when you knock on the door and want it back, they'll give it to you. Come on, everybody. Come, grow up. They'll be fiddling the price, shorting it, doing all sorts of stuff to control the price, as they have done with gold up until relatively recently, but they haven't been able to suppress it totally, which is why it's gone up 8.5% a year. But it hasn't actually. Of course, the dollar is degraded and the pound is degraded against it every year, but to the tune of 8.5%. That's the truth of the matter. But you and I know that. Some people don't know that. But here's the key. Bitcoin must be an international medium of exchange. It's not at the moment. You should be able to pick up the phone and buy your new Mercedes with Bitcoin. You should be able to go into a store and buy whatever you want with Bitcoin. Now, you can't do that at the moment. I would love to see the day when Bitcoin became a true medium of exchange. That's what I like to see. And it may well get there, but I'm not sure it'll get there in my lifetime at 74, 75. So my risk analysis is different from a younger man. Certainly, I think the early Bitcoiners were very clever because they saw how the game was playing out, and good for them, as I did with gold on a more modest level of growth. But good luck to all Bitcoiners, and I hope it works out well for them. But the beauty of Bitcoin was it's yours. It's in your personal wallet. You don't want BlackRock or Vanguard or the government regulators anywhere near it. It destroys the whole concept of Bitcoin. It stops being yours. You think, oh, I've got my wallet. I've got my password. Yeah, you might have. But you'll still find as the silver market up until quite recently too has been suppressed. You know, we're in the range of 13 years. 13 years ago, silver was $50 an ounce. It's $20 an ounce now. That thanks to JP Morgan suppressing the price and cheating on paper silver. That can happen with Bitcoin. Now, the people who really don't understand these matters, who are normally generally younger chaps who haven't worked in the city or Wall Street, don't understand how that can be done. I do know how it can be done. And I also know how it can be suppressed or buggered around. So when I get my gold, I get my gold coins, coin of the realm, no VAT, no capital gains tax. Once I've got that in my hand, the audit trail dies after 6 years in Britain. There is no audit trail. Because if you buy a big lump of coins, lots and lots of coins, it goes, you know, it's audited, there it is. It could be confiscated if the government came along and said, you know, Godfrey Bloom, you've got 100,000 pounds worth of gold coins and we want them. We're confiscating gold this year. But that falls off the cliff after 6 years. Now, with blockchain, the thing is with blockchain, you have a very definitive audit trail. So when you want to get out, that exposes, depending on to whom you sell your Bitcoin or who buys your Bitcoin, you have a very definitive audit trail. That's a weakness. It's a weakness in gold as well, but it's a bigger weakness when you have a blockchain. It's not a deal breaker. It's not a deal breaker, but there is a feeling that people say, "Oh well, no, I just wouldn't give my password." You know, if I don't get my password, they can't get my Bitcoin. And my answer to that is Julian Assange. They can do what they like. They can bang you up in solitary confinement if they think you've got it until they get your passcode. How long would you last in Belmarsh in solitary confinement before you gave them your password? Depends on who you are. most people would cough it up in less than 6 months.
Just on that point about gold, why is it that the audit trail disappears after 6 years? Is that just some kind of policy that we have to trust, or is there something?
That's just in this country. If I bought £100,000 worth of gold coin, and the gold bullion dealer would have to keep that trade on their books for 6 years for inspection.
Okay.
So if they wanted to get hold of my gold, they could go into the gold and say, "We want to see everybody who's bought over £10,000 worth of, it has to be a meaningful figure, over £50,000 worth of gold coins in the last 6 years." And then they'll go round and knock on the door. This happened, believe it or not, in Paris in the 1700s with the Mississippi bubble under John Law. And we've seen that kind of things happen. Roosevelt, of course, confiscated American gold in the 1930s. It can be done. But I think one needs to be pragmatic. Yes, it can be done. How would they do it? When could they do it? Given that it's not taxable, they would have to then confiscate what is coin of the realm, your gold Britannias or your gold. So very difficult to do. Plus, of course, the fact, as Michael Caine would say, not a lot of people know this, only about 1% of anybody's portfolio, 1% of portfolios is gold, is gold bullion. It's tiny. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. It used to be much more than that. It used to be 4 or 5%. And the Swiss franc was backed by gold. Now it's probably 15% backed by gold. So most people, who's got the gold? Who's got all the gold? The central banks. The central banks have been buying it. Now, I sniff the wind as an old geezer who's been around. If the central banks are buying it in big numbers, that's the place to be.
What do you mean by that? That's the place to be?
If they're buying gold.
Okay, I see.
I buy gold.
Right, okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely take your point, and I obviously, you know, some people are quite skeptical because obviously, like, the, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain, it is anyone can kind of look at it, and it is, I guess, more easily auditable in that sense. But I also just think people should buy outside of regulated exchanges anyway. I mean, you know, that would be my advice to anyone listening who is concerned about that, is just, you know, that there are ways to buy it peer-to-peer, and, you know, go through that, even if it means that you've got to pay, you know, 3% more, 4% more, 5% more. It's worth it to have that complete anonymity so that it's absolutely not such a name.
Anything that the government can't easily get their hands on, and Bitcoin and gold coins are one, they can't easily get their hands on it. I think that's the key. You take your money off the table. But the only, I would say, certainly, I think Bitcoin is for younger fellows who've got more time to take the volatility. That would be my only thing. But I'm not anti-Bitcoin. The trouble is, too many people think that it's either or. It's Bitcoin versus gold. It isn't. They've got a lot of the same characteristics. And that's why they attract the same kind of person who doesn't trust government, deep state, and central banks. You know, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. The trouble is with there are so many hodlers who think that somehow that if you are a gold bug, you're hostile to Bitcoin, or you're an idiot. And sometimes, occasionally, I get a little bit cross. I'm 74. I've won international prizes for fund management. I'm quite a clever little shit. I don't need somebody in Des Moines with $10,000 worth of Bitcoin telling me I don't know my business. Don't do that if you're watching, people. Don't do that. It does annoy me.
Yeah, I don't think that they are. I think that they're part of the same battle, and they have, you know, different qualities to each of them. And like you said, I think a good way of looking at it is that, you know, if you have a higher risk appetite, if you're younger, then, you know, maybe you want to put more into Bitcoin. And if you don't have as high a risk appetite, then maybe you want to put more into gold. But I definitely think that they're both fighting the same battle. And, you know, one of the things that I really love is that we can have conversations with this. You know, I'm someone who cares a lot about Bitcoin. You're someone who cares a lot about gold, but we have a lot of these kind of shared ideas. And I think that, you know, we are fighting that same battle, and it's good to have these kind of, I guess, more intergenerational conversations. So yeah, it's good to hear that you still have a positive view of Bitcoin, at least, although obviously, you know, you do have some skepticism when it comes to auditability. All right, I'll close on this final question because, you know, we are definitely coming up to time now. So just wanted to, well, first of all, thank you for coming on. It's been really great. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. And, you know, you're someone who I've kind of had on my list to talk to for a long time, and someone who's definitely inspired a lot of ideas in myself when it comes to economics and politics and that kind of thing. So, you know, very grateful that you've come and had this conversation.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, not at all. And yeah, I just want to give you the opportunity to give some of your closing thoughts. I guess maybe a message of positivity. I always try to kind of end on something a bit more positive towards the end of the conversation. And also just where people can get in touch with you if they want to find your work, if they want to learn more and see YouTube and things like that. Just let people know where they can find that.
Well, the best place to find my stuff is on my website, because everything I do, whether it's articles, or whether it's videos, or whether it's interviews, because I interview people of my channel, it's on my website, which is very easy, which is just godfreybloom.uk. Easy, couldn't be easier, godfreybloom.uk. So you'll find everything I've done. I've never taken anything down. So if I've written an article about how useless aircraft carriers are, and I did 5 years ago, it's still there. In 2016, I foretold that we would have this problem in the Ukraine and why and how it works. 2016. So a lot of the stuff I do actually unfurls as you go forward. So it's quite, I think it's quite an interesting website, and other experts on it. It's not just me, there's other folk, and particularly on the health page. I have a big health page there as well, with stuff from all over the world, experts from all over the world, very early on in the game, explaining how dangerous some of the ways we're going, WHO and all that kind of thing, are. So it's all there. The takeaway thing, I think, would be, first and foremost is you and your family. That's first and foremost. Don't try and worry too much about saving the planet. Save you and your family. That means look after your money. Whether you use Bitcoin or gold or silver, that's up to you. But make sure it's off the table, off the gut deep state table. Take it off the table. Make sure that you have some facility for getting through a bad patch. So you have some food, tin food, down below in the vaults or wherever you are, or in the attic or something. You've got lots and lots of tin stuff so you can get by. Get yourself a wee generator and make sure that you can protect, if you live in a certain area which might suffer from problems, which is more likely to be the big cities, that you are facilitated, and I'm not going any further than that, facilitated to protect your family physically. So that's something that you need to be aware of, because we are going back. If we're going to go back to the kind of dark ages, the only person that's going to protect you is you in this country, in Britain, and I suspect America. You have to look to yourself for protection. And we will hopefully come out of it, because it's all cyclical. Everything historically is cyclical. Sometimes the cycles are longer. So you saw the demise of the Roman Empire. That took quite a long time to sort the cycle to come out of that. And then you go into a new age of whether it's the Renaissance or something, and then it goes. So it is cyclical. I think we're coming into a low cycle. Just be prepared. That's the caper. If you're prepared for it, you and your family will get through it. And I wish you very good luck, and all your listeners very, very, very good luck in the future.